Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about episode 3 of The Scientist. Join with me as I go to well over 2,000 podcasts of cognitive rehab, learning how to read, remember things. I go back over an article. You can remember general things, not many. Now, we're going through this almost pop science book, a book which sort of reinforces the type of stuff which is taught to children in schools. And so the general idea is that scientists were always there, and for many years they were kicked around as the sort of loser in the playground, as other people had different games going on, but eventually science won because the science worked. And of course, this is really far from the truth, because the science is the child of religion. As people were struggling to understand God and understand each other, they eventually struck upon science along the way. And you have the greats like Giles of Rome, who came up with mass, St. Thomas Aquinas, who came up with the Newtonian framework of angel time. The sort of irony is that education now is stuck in the Middle Ages, and has instead told itself that it's not in the Middle Ages by making it stuff up about these scientists. So I'll read through here. The medieval Arab scientists. Now, it'd be interesting, because I've had a quick read through, sort of a sweep through the Persian Gulf, Bahrain, Kuwait, UAE, Oman, Yemen, and across to Mauritania, looking at these Arab origins and the sort of interesting sparks and joy and interest, and then I suppose confusion and horror, now locking themselves into slavery and abuse and camel stuff like that. Okay, during the period known in Europe as the Dark Ages, the Middle East became the intellectual hub of the world, and a string of brilliant Arab scientists sowed the seeds that would later be reaped in the scientific revolution of the 17th century. I would actually agree with that. It's hard to like that algebra brought it in. There was some concepts there. It's I think the seeds were sown in the fertile ground of the Quran, is my thing. And so this is the 8th century AD. So the 8th century AD, people were digging up popes, putting fraudulent documents around, suckering in the Franks to invade on their behalf. So really the Machiavellian aspects of the dark Middle Ages were coming up around this time. So for me, that's full-on Middle Ages. Al-Khwarizmi gives us our number system and algebra. Ibn Sina, Avicenna, wrote the greatest book on medicine for 1,000 years, and Al-Biruni's pioneering work included comparison of the speed of light and sound. The great flowering of Arab science began with what's sometimes called the Golden Age of Islam, and time when consolidating influence of Islamic religion saw Arab Muslims begin to build an empire that was to stretch from the Middle East across North Africa into Spain. Well, at the heart of the Islamic world lay the city of Baghdad, where the caliphs ruled. Okay, having read that, there's just so many different aspects of it. That's a huge simplification. So you've got the Omanis pushed off and people not ruling and warring and stuff like that. The rule of the caliphs reached its zenith under the Abbasid dynasty, in particular the reign of Caliph Harun al-Rashid, son of al-Mu'min. So it would be Harun al-Rashid bin al-Mu'min. Harun He gave him this. Gave. Sorry. Harun. Al-Rashid, who became caliph in AD 786, has become famous for the fictional role given him in The Thousand and One Nights. You know, the Arabian stuff. So it's a fictional role, which may have been partly written in his reign, but his reign marked the beginning of an astonishing flower of culture in Baghdad. So AD 786, I don't think that's too many years after the Prophet had been there. But as Iran, the nature of Islam meant that scholarship was treasured, and Baghdad became the centre of unrivaled intellectual activity in all fields, including between the branches, including science, technology, poetry, and philosophy. I think it didn't treasure it, it just actually required it to operate. Yeah, so the Prophet gave the Islam, and the Islam was simple to read natural codes, and then those natural codes, to get the advantage on it, you had to propel science. Arab scholars saw no distinction between branches of thought, and many would study mathematics or write poetry with equal zeal. Oh, that's just such a non-statement. Under the caliph of Harun's son Al-Mamun in 813 on, Baghdad drew scholars from far and wide to work in the House of Wisdom, created by the caliph about 820, which is really interesting because there's the House of Wonders in Zanzibar. So it's sort of like, I love this house. The House of Wisdom was a mixture of library, research institute, and university, i.e. sort of like a modern CRC, Cooperative Research Centre in Australia. Indeed, it was the first great library since Alexandria had been destroyed by the Christians, in brackets, possibly in the 1st century BC. One of the house, I think it was burnt by Christians after the 1st century BC, but no, I'm confused by that. One of the House of Wisdom scholars' tasks was to translate the great works of the Greek thinkers, and it is largely through their efforts that the Greeks' ideas were preserved through the Dark Ages. But the scholars also did practical research, establishing the world's first proper astronomical observatory, for instance. They developed the astrolabe, one of the most influential scientific instruments of all time, allowing astronomers to measure the position of stars with unparalleled accuracy. I like this sort of something in there, the word unparalleled and accuracy. So astrolabe is just basically a sort of a set square with a vision on it, so you can actually see where things are. In medicine, they improved diets, made the first serious study of drugs, and advanced surgery hugely. Now, surgery is something where you've got to get all the little ducks lined up to get right, so as I well know. Indeed, Muslim scholars of the Golden Age made important and original contributions to mathematics, astronomy, medicine, and chemistry. I like it. It's an important contribution and they're original. When Al-Mum died in 833, the central role of influence in Baghdad had begun to wane, but in its place, energetic products of scholarship began to spring up throughout the Islamic world. The great Al-Barundi lived under the patronage of the Ghaznavid caliphs in the east, while Ansfinia lived under the Samarinds caliphs in Bakura. Look, I think this is largely correct, that Baghdad waned just as well as it did, because it was about to be smashed by the Mongol invaders. You know? So it's not necessarily a bad thing that something decays. So if you would say the US empire is decaying now, but its legacy is being squirreled away throughout the world. al-Khwarizmi. Very little known about the life of al-Khwarizmi, which in brackets I would say gives them open slot to make things up. And much of his life story seems to be pure conjecture. And we're going to have more conjecture here, I'm sure. It seems likely conjecture that he was born in what is now known as Uzbekistan, south of the Aral Sea in Central Asia. It's likely because we've ruled out Iceland and other places in Australia. Some scholars say his father was a Zoroastrian and he was brought up in the ancient faith, which dates back to the time of ancient Sumeria. So Zoroastrians believe in fire. So they were burning fire oil fields. Others say this is completely misinterprets the records. All we do know is that al-Khwarizmi was born about 786, possibly given if they know his death or any fact and his average lifespan, you could get him, the year al-Harizid came to power, and that when Harizid's son al-Mu'min set up the House of Wisdom, al-Khwarizmi was there studying. So he was the vaguest of things. He was studying there, so his birth date was probably around him. So he could have been 18 or something like that. One of the greatest contributions was to provide a comprehensive guide to the Hindu numbering system, which originated in India about AD 500 AD. So this is the start of the Arabic symbols. The numbering system is position sensitive. So 1009 is different from 9001. Same numbers, but in different positions, which is sort of interesting. And but it also says that the spread of empires allows information to flow into the empires. Now we've got the internet now, so this really scrambles this process. It is this system called the Arabic system because it came to Europe from al-Khwarizmi, that same basis of our modern numbers. The Arab system, clearly explained by al-Khwarizmi in his book on Hindu numerals, uses only 10 digits, 0 to 9, to give every single number from 0 up to the biggest number imaginable. The value given to each digit is simply according to its position. So 1 in 100 is 10 times greater than 1 in 10, and 100 times greater than 1 in 1. It was a huge advance on the previous numbering system, which became incredibly cumbersome for large numbers. Now, the numbering system was sort of like reckoning. So it's a bit to the right of that last tree you went past, you know, that there. So it's something easy to remember and relative. So it's 1 less than 5. Yeah, which we really want 5 here. The Roman numbering system, which needed 7 digits to give a number as small as 38, XXXXXVIII. The Arabic numbering system, see, that's really not as cool as I would think what's best is if you could get 50 something worthy, but just keep on subtracting. 7 digits in the Arabic numerals can, of course, be anything up to 10 million. What's more, by standardizing units, the Arabic numerals made multiplication, division, and every other form of mathematical calculation much simpler. But they didn't do that initially when they came on. Not surprisingly, when it reached Europe, it quickly caught on. Oh, I don't think that's a complete lie. And since the spread around the world became a truly global language. Look, just make me vomit. That's, I think when I read the actual history, it didn't catch on. It took a lot of effort for it to catch on. With the numbers, Europe gained another word to algorithm, for which a logical step-by-step mathematical process is based on the spelling of al-Khwarizmi's name in the Latin type of the book, Algorithmi del Numero Indorum. I love that, an algorithm. Okay. Inventing algebra. The introduction of Arabic numerals owed something to Hindu mathematicians. Al-Khwarizmi and other contributions was much more than his own work. This introduced a word to our language named algebra and a whole new branch of mathematics. What is interesting is the developing algebra. So algebra was in the Yemeni developed in the Yemeni Empire on the west coast of Saudi Arabia on the the Red Sea. Al-Khwarizmi had something eminently practical in mind, not just abstract theory. His introduction to his book, in which he describes sepulture, he says the aim of his work is which is the easiest and most useful of mathematics, such as men constantly require in cases of inheritance, legacies, partitions, lawsuits, and trade, and all their dealings with one another when measuring lands, digging canals, and making geometrical calculations, end quote. Which is sort of rather remarkable. My grandfather wrote a maths teaching book in 1920, and it's sort of almost word for word that sort of, you know, he's going to learn maths and it's practical. Whether you would interpret an introduction to someone writes to a book is sort of like if someone was selling a house and you'd say, look, they're optimists, and they could be real pessimists, but they're trying to sell a house. Although we now associate algebra entirely with the idea of symbols replacing unknown numbers in calculations, Alcuin did not actually use symbols. They had to wait for Descartes. For he wrote everything out fully in words. It was his way of handling equations that created algebra. And it's really interesting. His way of handling equations was involved in Newton. So Newton didn't have algebra. Completing and balancing. In his work on algebra, Al-Khwarizmi worked with both what we now call linear equations, that is, equations that involve only units without squared figures, and quadratic equations, which involve squares and square roots. His great breakthrough was to reduce every equation to its simplest possible form by a combination of two processes, algebra and al-makba. Algebra means completion, which involves simply taking away all negative terms. Using modern symbols, algebra means simplifying. For instance, x squared equals 40x minus 4x to just 5x squared equals 40x. Al-makba means balancing, involves reducing all possible terms to the simplest form. When it reduces, for instance, 50 plus 3x plus x squared equals 29 plus 10x to just 21 plus x squared equals 7x. So you'd be looking for the multiples of 21 there. It would be a bit of complex to reduce it. In this way, he could reduce every equation to six simple standard forms and then showed a method of solving each. He went on to provide geometrical proofs for each of his methods. Some scholars say that these proofs he must have read Euclid's geometries, especially as some of his colleagues in the House of Wisdom had translated Euclid's the Elements. Others say, it's almost like reading the Sun newspaper. Others say they are so markedly different from Euclid's that his geometry came from elsewhere. Allah, I would say. In developing algebra, Al-Khwarizmi built on the work of Hindu mathematicians such as Brahmagupta. But it was Al-Khwarizmi who turned it into a simple, all-embracing system. He was rightly dubbed the father of algebra, the granddaddy of algebra. The very word algebra comes from the title of his book, Al-Khalib Al-Masqda Fi Hisab Al-Jabra Wal-Mufralaba, or the compendious book on calculating by completion and balancing. So algebra means completion. The world and the stars. Like all the Arab scholars, Al-Khwarizmi had interests beyond mathematics. Eating, I suppose. Apart from his book on numbers and algebra, he wrote a third major book on geography called Kitab Sarut al-Arad, which is like an Australian trying to pronounce some Arabic words in an old book, but it means the image of the earth. This reintroduced some of Ptolemy's ideas on describing positions through longitude and latitude, but improved their accuracy, particularly for the length of the Mediterranean Sea and locations of cities in Asia and Africa. Now, it's really interesting that the Mongols, when they came across the maps of Europe, were very interested indeed. They had even scouts which went up to the Alps. Particularly in the locations of cities in Asia and Africa. Al-Khwarizmi also helped create a map of the world for Caliph Al-Mu'min and got involved in a project to measure the circumference of the earth by measuring the length of degree of one longitude through the plain of Sinjar in Iraq. Scholars in this part of the world had long moved beyond the idea of the world as flat. I don't know who's got the flat world. At some time in his life, Al-Khwarizmi, I think really it's really dumb artists which produce that. Al-Khwarizmi worked on astronomical problems too. He compiled astronomical tables and developed a table of signs for helping calculate the position of stars. Al-Khwarizmi's work took perhaps 3 centuries to reach Western Europe, and probably via Moorish Spain. But when it did arrive, the impact was lasting. Arabic numbers and the algebra are central to its lives. I just think that person hasn't got scholarship. I read a book on maths, and they're very clear about the person, the monk who was fiddling around with Arab numerals and was just poo-poo. Okay. Ibn Sina of Ventsia. Born in Bakura around 980, so this is a long time after. Ibn Sina, sometimes known by his Latin name Vincentia, oh, that's where, so he wasn't born then, was something of a prodigy. It said that by the age of 10, he knew not just the Quran, but most of Arab poetry by heart. By the age of 16, he'd become a qualified physician. Yep. Yeah, that's some people's student skills are baffling. His skills as a physician became most legendary, and although the turbulent politics at the time kept him permanently unsettled, i.e. the Mongol invasions, but there was various things, Bruno, various philosophers managed to move about the place because they could, they were, oh, you can fix my sore toe, excellent, you come up here and do it. Through his skills as a physician made him almost legendary. Okay, he was a physician to a succession of princes and caliphs. But he also became the most famous philosopher, scholar, mathematician, and astronomer of the age, and wrote books on a huge range of scientific topics, a vast encyclopedia, the first ever written, and, well, okay. And even wrote a short poems, one of which goes, we'll give you the poem later. I would say Pliny the Elder would be in the running for an encyclopedia. Just myself. Quote, up from the earth's centre through the seventh gate I rose, and on the throne of Saturn sat, and many a knot unravelled by the road, but not by the master knot of human fate. Profound. I don't quite understand what it means. It doesn't speak to me personally. Ibn Sina made a number of key astronomical observations, devised a vernier scale to help make readings more precise, and made a string of key contributions to physics, such as identifying the different forms of energy, heat, light, and mechanical. And the idea of force. Now, that's a whole series of really great things. So energy means, energia means ergonomic, means ability to do work, and force is related between it. I would say that Newton really nailed force myself. My point is the vernier scale is fantastic. It's this way of having a slightly out of step scale, and when the scale, you can, it'll be a little bit out of step, and you can measure how much out of step it is. It's fantastic. I love vernier scales. It's one of these things which is lost on modern kiddies. He noted that if light consists of a stream of particle, then its speeds must be finite. Absolutely. That's right. If I make a dumb conjecture... Yeah, that's just... What a load of crap. The mathematical technique of casting out nines used to verify squares and cubes is also attributed to Sinner. I wish I knew what casting out nines was. Yet his fame is above all based on his book called Alquan Fil Al Tib, The Canon of Medicine. We're going to bring up the canon of medicine. It's like, this vast tome consisting of over a million words surveyed the entire field of medical knowledge from ancient times to the most up-to-date Muslim techniques. Its comprehensive systematic approach meant that once it was translated into Latin in the 12th century, it became the medical standard textbook in Europe for the next 600 years. Suffer, everybody. Besides bringing together existing knowledge, the canon contains some of Sinner's own insights. He's the first to recognise, for instance, that tuberculosis and virus are contagious. That diseases can be spread through the soil and water, and a person's emotions can affect their state of physical health. Absolutely, that last one. He was also the first to describe meningitis and realise that the nerves transmit pain. Now, I think it was Galen who had the dog which was barking. He stopped barking by cutting a nerve. His book also contained a description of 760 drugs and also became a doctor's Bible for centuries to come. Okay, we're coming up to someone else called Al-Biruni. The Persian scholar Al-Biruni lived around the same time as Ibn Sina. Okay, so towards the end where you have the mighty Arab Empire being smashed by the Mongol invaders. And the two are known to have corresponded. Okay, I don't like that letter. We have letters of the two. He had a special gift for languages and is said to have spoken Turkish, Persian, Sanskrit, Hebrew, Syriac, and besides his native Arabic. He was patronized by Ghaznavid Caliph Muhammad, who took Al-Biruni with him when he went on campaigns in India. Great on you, India. He was probably how Al-Biruni learned the languages. Certainly his most famous book, Kitab al-Hindi, the Book of India. Oh, it's India. Hindi means India. Came out of these travels. Although he's not known for any particular scientific advance, his contributions ranged a wide spectrum. So my only question is, why are you in this book of great scientific scientists? Well, let's see. He was the first to firmly establish trigonometry as a branch of mathematics. He wrote treatises on the effects of drugs in medicine. He pioneered the idea of light travels faster than sound. He promoted the idea the Earth rotates on its axis, made many accurate calculations about latitude and longitude, and suggested, contrary to received opinion at the time, that Africa might not stretch south forever. He also accurately measured the densities of 18 precious stones and metals and noted that flowers have 3, 4, 5, 6 or 8 petals, but never 7 or 9, which is partly Fibonacci, partly to do with DNA mathematics. It's all really interesting, that type of crap. Okay, so we're up to... Obviously, we've done the Arabs. That's it. Bit of poetry thing. Now we come straight to Leonardo da Vinci. Cardinal Giles of Rome and Doubt. Oh, come to me, and I'd love to understand Spinoza and all this type of stuff. Oh, I just really brain cannot work on that thing. Okay, so he is from 1452 to 15... I can't believe that. Was that... this is a new section. That was it. Okay, well, I'll read Leonardo da Vinci. Learned ignorance. someone. I cannot think of his name. Okay, just lifting out huge planks. Although best known for his masterful paintings such as the Mona Lisa, well, he wasn't known at the time for Mona Lisa. It was in the bathroom of Francis. Leonardo da Vinci is revealed as a remarkable scientist by his notebooks, perhaps the greatest scientist of the modern age. We know that Leonardo was a remarkable scientist only from the surviving pages of his notebooks. There are thousands of these pages, each packed with Leonardo's extraordinary drawings and writings on a huge range of subjects. Huge range of subjects. Geology, anatomy, astronomy, gravity, flight, optics, and much, much more. Gravity's just in there. Just pop it in there. I don't know how you could write on gravity. Beyond me. Just 15, no, often Leonardo flits from one topic to another on a single page. Most famous of all of Leonardo da Vinci's inventions. Within the pages are sketches and notes for scores of machines and devices. Some of them just tentative ideas, some fully worked out with detailed drawings. What is astonishing? He is an astonishing drawer. I can't believe how well he can draw. What is astonishing is not just the sheer range of the problems that Leonardo puts his mind to, from war machines to water supply, but just how many of his ideas are almost unnervingly ahead of his time. Helicopters, tanks, cars, aeroplanes, bicycles, parachutes, all appears in Leonardo's pages 500 years before they became a reality. It seems unlikely, though. Leonardo tried many of these amazing ideas. It seems unlikely, too, that anyone else even knew about them, except the few who acquired pages from the notebooks down the ages. The same goes for scientific writings. And that sort of goes to me a little bit. I'm not in this Leonardo da Vinci things, but I have seen quantum phenomena and lasers, which, and done maths, which I just don't have a lifetime to write out. Maybe it'll come out at some stage. But you just have to sort of enjoy and think you're in your own universe a bit. Leonardo's tiny writings, often written backwards in mirror form, probably to make it easier for him to write left-handed, is difficult to decipher. But as a result of scholars' studies of Leonardo's scientific writings, he has emerged as one of the finest scientific minds in history. His notes on the subject of anatomy and astronomy reveal him to have almost as far ahead of his time in his science as he is in his inventions. In geology, in particular, Leonardo was discussing sediments, strata and fossils, and the age of the Earth in a way that anticipated great debates of the early 19th century. Over 300 years later, even more significantly, Leonardo's great emphasis on first-hand observation foresaw a scientific approach that was to have such an impact centuries later. He wrote, quote, "Things of the mind left untested by the senses are useless." So it really is the... I was trying to think... a rationalist... It is sort of pretty amazing, rationalist. And the big question is, why would you write things down? Would you go back to your notes and look at it, or for someone else, stuff like that? Yet, for whatever reason, Leonardo kept his thoughts to himself. No one knows exactly why he wrote the notebooks. Most people believe his plan was eventually to publish them in a book. Why most people do? They're pretty dumb. I think the notes would keep him company. If you can't speak to anybody, that's my theory. I think that's why you do lots of things. If you're intellectual and you've got no one around you, no one cares, you podcast away. He was basically podcasting, mate. But by keeping quiet about his ideas, he ensured that all his extraordinary insight, he actually had little impact on the progress of science, and is best known today as an artist. One can only speculate how different things might have been if his ideas became known. Oh, that's dumb. I can only speculate that the Middle Ages didn't happen or something like that. Childhood of Da Vinci. Leonardo was born on the 15th of April, 1452 in a little Tuscan town known as Vinci. His mother was a 16-year-old servant girl called Catrina, while his father was a local notary solicitor called Serpero. After his birth, Serpero married the local heiress called Albira, while Camira was quickly married off to the local cowherd, leaving the baby in Serpero's care. Serpero and his new wife had little time for the infant, who was looked after mainly by his grandparents and Uncle Francisco. So this is interesting about parenting, about, you know, was he in childcare? What's his relationship with people? Was it really stuffed up? When you look at Einstein and Newton, they've got a really stuffed up life to start off with. And how does that go into your brain thing? So if you make a very happy child, do you produce this? You can produce monsters and you can produce these things. Even as a child, Leonardo proved extraordinarily gifted. He learned to play the lyre. It says not play, L-I-A-R-L-Y-R-E, and sing beautifully. Was adept at horse riding and showed a remarkable aptitude for mathematics. Almost a Disney character, wasn't he? He would often go wandering through the countryside by himself around Vinci, always carrying a notebook to make his already striking sketches of plants and animals. Do we know that is true? I don't know. Leonardo in Florence. When his grandfather died in 1486, the family moved to Florence. Florence, at the time, was the most exciting creative city in all of Europe. Dominating it was Bellini's spectacular new cathedral dome. But down below, it was teeming streets where scores of workshops and studios turning out a stream of brilliant art, such as Gibraltar baptistry doors and Donatello's statue of David. Oh, that's interesting. So it's not Michelangelo's David, is it? I'm not sure. Leonardo's father was by now well aware of his son's artistic talents and sent him to study at the studio of Andrea Ferraccio, and then the most famous sculptor, painter, and goldsmith in Florence. You get that feeling, it's sort of like the tourist trade happening. Leonardo was a fast learner, we hope, and soon surpassed his master in skill, causing Virtue, legend has it, to give up painting in despair. At this time, he cut a dashing figure around town in pink pantaloons and stuff like that. Wearing overshort, shocking pink breeches. There you go. People have speculated about his sexuality, and he seems never to have had any interest in women, writing in his notebooks, quote, "The act of procreation and anything that has in relation to it is so disgusting that human beings should die out if there was no pretty faces and sensuous dispositions." Well, I can't see there's anything wrong with that. Okay, whatever the truth, his disinterest in personal relationships left him with plenty of time to work on his ideas and develop his art, which is one of the things I really think that if you're a good relationships person, it's hard to, it's sort of like, life's got one or two tracks and you've got to actually move between the two of them. Leonardo in Milan, and then Leonardo on the move, Leonardo in France, and Leonardo Carcer. But let's go. In 1480, he received his first great art commission from Lorenzo the Magnificent, the head of Florence's ruling family, the Medicis. Lorenzo began work on this painting, The Adoration of Margin, but before long abandoned it to write to Ludovico Soracca. The Duke of Milan, advertising his services not primarily as a painter and sculptor, but as a military engineer. His letter of introduction, he talked of his ability to make armoured carts, siege engines, portable assault bridges, and catapults. Ludovico ignored this letter, but later summoned Leonardo of Milan, where he stayed for 70 years until the French captured the city in 1499, and Ludovico fled. The French were pretty awful people. I can still remember them putting people to death. I think I read the Quantum Astrologer, and that French pretty awful. Throughout his time in Milan, Leonardo was kept busy painting, staging court festivals, and advising on architecture, fortification, drain, water supply, and anything else of technical nature, except probably armoured cars and things. His greatest achievement in Milan was the painting of the Last Supper at 1495 to 98, considered by some the finest painting ever. Something is about it, about the Last Supper. What I'd like is it's for a rectory. So there's God having a tucking in, going to be crucified tomorrow. Got to get a good nice in, break a bit of wine, sort of set your mass up and running, and now you eat your food. It's sort of nice feeling there. You can imagine the Middle Ages. His most time-consuming project, though, was a giant bronze statue of Davitico on horseback. This became the most celebrated of Leonardo's many overambitious failures. And when he met Michelangelo, the great sculptor mocked him for it. Antagonized, the two artists embarked on a duel by paint. Both were to paint a giant mural of a battle scene. Leonardo began painting the Battle of Ancari, and Michelangelo did the Battle of Cinsari. Neither artist finished their work, but it was their preparing for the painting that Leonardo did much of his anatomical research, spending time in Florence, Santa Maria Nova Hospital, studying injuries and also dissecting corpses. He later planned to publish his anatomical manuscript in 1510, but his plan came to nothing. Leonardo on the move from 1500. The political instability of the times meant Leonardo was constantly on the move between Florence, Venice, Rome, and various other Italian cities, never staying more than a year or two at each. For a few years, he was in the service of the ruthless Caesar Borgia, and travelled across the Caesar's lands, surveying them with many techniques that anticipated modern cartography. Oh, well, there you go. In 1503, Leonardo surveyed and planned a route of the canal to connect Florence to the sea. In 1505, at about the time he was losing interest in the Battle of Agadi, the painting of the famous Mona Lisa, he wrote a book about the flight of birds, and over the next 2 years, he filled his notebooks with ideas of flying machines, including helicopters and parachutes. You can imagine that by painting angels and all the things flying up in the air. I don't know. I like the idea that you're painting, you put your concepts aloft, and you have the angels floating. And here's a bird floating. I wonder how that happens. By the time he was 60, Leonardo was beginning to tire of having to move all the time. He accepted a gift of room from the Vatican in Rome. In 1513, he stayed there for 3 years, hoping for a commission, but all the projects were going to others such as Michelangelo and Brandi. Leonardo probably worked for a while as a consultant on the Pope's plan to reclaim the Pontine marshes, but there was not much else. He may have also spent the time investigating optical puzzles and experimenting with flight. So, in 1516, the aging artist accepted an invitation from King Francois I of France and left Italy for good, and made the most chamois, the biggest, airiest, coldest, impractical American hotel sitting in the Middle Ages, is his idea. In France, Leonardo took up a residence at a house in Cluj, provided by Francois, and settled down to work on his notebooks. By this time, he had a stroke, and his right hand was partially paralysed, so his work was slow. Fortunately, the king did not expect any substantial works from him. All Leonardo had to do was produce plans for festivals and plays and provide designs for toys, such as a mechanical lion which opened its mouth to reveal Lilies within the beast. Indeed, the French king was such a great admirer of Leonardo, he was generally pleased to have him around. Poor Leonardo was constantly interrupted by visits by the well-meaning Francois, who walked through a tunnel that connected his Amboise palace to Leonardo's house. I think Amboise was it? Chambord is it? Leonardo died quietly and closed in 23rd of April 1519, and was buried in the nearby church of Saint Florentin. The church was destroyed in the French Revolution, and Leonardo's remains were lost. His young companion, Franzo Melns, was grief-stricken and stayed in the house for months before finally packing up all of Leonardo's belongings, including 13,000 priceless pages of his notes, and heading off the car to Vaprio, Italy, where the notes remained in his care until he died and left them to his son Orozo to look after. Orozo had no interest in Leonardo's notes, stuffing some of the notebooks in a cupboard in the attic and giving the others away. As word spread about the notebooks, so collectors descended on Rapu, taking bits away and often ripping pages out, scattering Leonardo's work. Today, the pages are distributed among the museums and private collections, including the famous Codex Leicester, bought by Microsoft founder Bill Gates in 1994 for $3 million. The original pages are of most... almost half have been lost. Okay, so I think we're going to finish this with this Leonardo's... Oh, no. Two things in Leonardo's. Leonardo's notebooks reveal an astonishing range of inventions. Clocks, printing presses, drills, boats, diving suits, cars, battle tanks. Not just tanks, battle tanks. Yeah, perhaps what are you going to do with a battle tank? He hasn't... I suppose... the tanks, of course, don't have tracks or anything like that. At the heart of Leonardo's thinking was the belief that human animal bodies are simply organic machines. This belief underpinned many of his investigations to astronomy, anatomy, and also inspired many of his inventions. He was looking at birds flying that convinced Leonardo that flying machines was feasible. Quote, "A bird is simply an instrument functioning according to the laws of nature," quote, he wrote, "in which case man can recreate that instrument." His first designs for flying machines depended on flapping wings, are known as ornithopters. In 1487, he made a drawing of an ornithopter with a pilot laying flat on the frame and his feet in the stirrups, pedaling to make the wings flap. A few years later, he came up with a design for an ornithopter with rudders and elevators to give control and flight. A remarkably advanced idea. Ornithopters would never have worked because of human muscle power. It simply isn't great enough. Leonardo may have realised this himself because he soon dropped the idea of flapping wings in order to work on gliders. To further his knowledge of wings and airflow, Leonardo studied birds and falling leaves, and doing so invented the world's first aerometer to measure wind speed. 10 years before he died, he drew a design for a glider that had a genuine control system, not unlike a modern hang gliders. Leonardo wrote, quote, "This man will move to the right if he bends his right arm and extends his left, and then he will move to the right, from the right to the left, by changing the position of his arms. Recently, experts have built a machine based exactly on his design, using only materials that would have been available to Leonardo, and proved that it would not only have been able to fly, but it could have been controlled in flight, something not achieved until the Wright brothers' famous flight in 1903. I think that's sort of getting a bit wanky. Leonardo realized that wings are not the only way of flying. He designed a helicopter to climb vertically in the air, carrying men and the platform underneath. Unlike modern helicopters, it did not have rotor blades, but a spiral screw designed to lift it up through the air. Helicopter toys and rotors had actually been around for centuries, yet Leonardo was the first, and perhaps the last, for 500 years to try and design one for lifting people. So that's an important thing to do in terms of that they have these little helicopter toys going around. Leonardo clearly grasped the air has enough substance to support aerofoil shapes and designed a machine based on a boat with oars in which a pilot rode through the air. Although it clearly would not work, he at least recognised the principle that has led to propellers rotors centuries later. Yeah, I think if a monk drew it, we'd say, how cute. Now, here's anatomy and Leonardo's man, special man. This is the famous four-legged armed man in the circle, you know, that you can stand in a circle and things like that. It's perhaps his work in anatomy that Leonardo had the most lasting impact on the progress of science. At the time, when most physicians were learning about the human body from the 2nd century Galen, Leonardo dissected corpses to find things out for himself. I don't know. He was not the only one to do this. Oh, well, yeah, I didn't know this. As it was expected, an artist should know anatomy. At around the same time as Leonardo was in Florence, for instance, Florentine painter Antonio Belvini wrote a treatise based on his own dissections. Yet Leonardo went much, much further in his analysis, dissecting over 30 human corpses personally and conducting many experiments to see how parts of the body work. He also dissected bears, cows, frogs, monkeys, birds to compare the anatomy of that of humans. Leonardo's superlative skill in illustration and his obsession with accuracy made his anatomical journeys the finest the world had ever seen. In order to display the layers of the body, he developed a drawing technique called cross-section, and that is still used today. He also developed remarkable three-dimensional arrays of muscles and organs from different perspectives, a technique that has only come into its own age with the computer age. So he did tomography. One of Leonardo's special interests was the eye. He was fascinated by how the eye and the brain worked together. He was probably the first anatomist ever to see how the optic nerve leads the back of the eye and connects to the brain. He was probably the first, too, to realise how nerves link the brain to the muscles. There have been no such ideas in Galen's anatomy. I think that's just complete wank if you know the stories of Galen. It is probably, and it's interesting that they've got Galen here, but they don't mention Galen as well in the book, in the Book of Famous Scientists. It is perhaps his study of muscles where Leonardo's blend of artistry and scientific analysis is best seen. He observed exactly what happens to muscles when they move the body in different ways, how muscles in the face make people smile or frown, and much more. Just, I don't know, this strikes me as just a very low quality at this stage. Maybe I'm getting old and fardy. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.